You're listening to Jeremy Beck on today's News Talk Radio, TNT.
Yes, and I'm filling in for Mike Ryan on The Mike Ryan Show. Let's look at a couple of news headlines. Israeli military drone maker hacked. A US-based branch of Israel's Elbit Systems, a company specializing in unmanned aerial vehicles, has fallen victim to a hack that impacted nearly 400 employees, the company said, noting that sensitive personal data was likely stolen from its US branch, Elbit America. Australia's telecommunications company Optus has also reported a serious data breach. So it's clear that personal data is at risk, and even in some of the most secure, supposedly, I would have thought the most secure companies, you know, an Israeli military drone maker, I would have thought would have some of the highest levels of security. And yet 400 of its employees have had their data breached. In Australia, the case with Optus, we are talking millions of people who have had their data hacked. It's a real problem. But I'm concerned that there are actors who would use this to try and save us, you know, the problem, reaction, solution sort of paradigm. And that is a big concern, that governments around the world will use these incidences to push certain legislation which could head us down the kind of digital identity paradigm where we're going to save you in a certain way, and it may not be the case. Just something to watch out on, though, I think. Another headline, Dean Cain calls it ridiculous that he had to wear a mask. American actor Dean Cain, well known for his role as Superman in the TV series Lois and Clark, tweeted, "Found it utterly ridiculous that I had to wear a mask on the plane flying to and from Canada." Now, some on social media pounced on the actor's remark, but Dean Cain fired back and stood his ground, and good on him for doing that. He had a response. One of the responses on Twitter was, "If only you thought about others." And he fired back, "If only you thought for yourself." And that's a very good point, because people just parrot absolute nonsense. They don't think for themselves. And particularly with reference to these face masks, there are so many people still wearing them today. And I live in Melbourne, and I go out to the shops in Melbourne, which was the most lockdown city, which obviously terrorised so many people that they still believe that, I don't know what they believe. It's amazing. But there's so many people that still walk around in a face mask. Now, it's not required to wear a face mask in the shops or outdoors or anything like that, and you still see it happening. And people are not thinking for themselves. It's just nuts. Fortunately, people who listen to TNT radio do. Otherwise, you wouldn't be listening, would you? Now, if you missed your favourite TNT radio show or interview, simply listen back when you want, wherever you want. Just visit episodes on the TNT radio website. We are also on all major podcast platforms, including Apple, Google, Spotify, Amazon, Podbean, iHeart, and TuneIn. Now, there's no reason to miss out on anything on TNT radio.
It's the stuff.
It's that division
people are talking about.
And that cluelessness that they want to push.
Today's News Talk Radio, TNT.
Issues in rural Australia are important for all Australians. After all, if our farmers are in trouble, so is our food security. And much of our economic activity, which supports the nation, occurs outside of the big cities. Many city dwellers chatter about various politically correct subjects, but there are much bigger issues at stake, and my next guest will no doubt talk about some of those. Robbie Katter is Katter's Australian Party state leader in Queensland and member for Traeger in Queensland's Parliament. Traeger is the state's second largest electorate, covering a massive 428,911 square kilometres in the north of the state. Wow, that's huge. Robbie's is served on the Mount Isa City Council as councillor for 4 years before being elected state member for Mount Isa. Welcome to TNT Radio, Robbie.
No, thanks for having me.
Now, first of all, Premier Palaszczuk has announced yesterday a plan for a so-called clean energy future, which includes the biggest pump hydro scheme in the world. Now, this is all proposed on a sort of a green sort of solar wind sort of scenario where the solar and the wind energy would pump the water up into some storage, because otherwise they're pretty useless. But even still, it's a crazy system. What do you think of it?
Look, you know, I find it very hard to restrain myself and responding on this announcement by the Premier. I'm not going to say I'm altogether against renewables or pumped hydro, but I mean, and people just got to think of pumped hydro like batteries. And in the grand scheme of things, it would make sense to focus on that because they want to embark on this journey towards renewables, which is going to require, and at the same time, electric cars, which is going to require an astonishing amount of increased capacity and generation capacity in this state. And like to try and, you know, see that materialise, what that means in terms of taking up land, like the solar farms and the wind farms, the amount of area, land area that takes up, and I think the risk of strategic ag land that's going to threaten just throws up so many questions to me. But if you did want to go on that journey, it would make sense that you talk about pumped hydro. And if you did have buy-in to say that this was the most important thing for our state to engage in at the moment, but I sort of have trouble in responding to this in a mature way, because I feel a great part of this is just about the politics of it, you know, announcing things. The government's on the nose for a number of issues. It's not handling youth crime or health or a number of portfolios. It's failing in a lot of areas. So it, you know, wants to throw out something big and bold that makes them look like they're doing something. That you know, I'd start the answer by saying we currently, well, on the, if you pay an ergon bill in Queensland, which is most of regional Queensland, outside the southeast, an element of that bill and a significant element of that bill goes towards subsidising renewables, and that's a fact. So, and to engage in more renewables and do more of that, and mums and dads and businesses are going to be paying for it. And a lot of people might be okay with that, but I would argue that a lot of people are already struggling with the cost of living, and I don't think the government's being upfront about what this costs us. So I'm not saying it's crazy to put the pumped hydro in. Batteries are needed if you want to expand the renewable network, but I'd also throw in that it's, you know, curious to say the least, but I would say madness to plough forward with these renewables targets and trying to get rid of coal, which is part of this whole plan, is the opposite to what the rest of the world's doing right now. They've tried unsuccessfully to move towards renewables. We just had a big reminder recently. We almost had to start load shedding here in Queensland. Well, we did in part start load shedding because at times, the network can't handle it. But even then, that hasn't been a good enough reminder for the government. They're still ploughing ahead with this, and perhaps they think they're more competent and able than the rest of the other major Western countries in the world. But I for one, think they certainly aren't. And they're going to just plunge us down this path, and or charge us down this path, if you like. And this, you know, this major pumped hydro, Mackay, is part of that. So I just have enormous concerns on so many levels with what the government's talking about, and they certainly have form in terms of just doing these things on an ideological or political basis rather than a common sense or practical basis.
Exactly right. And the amount of area that you'd have to cover the state with wind farms or solar cells or what have you to generate the same amount of power is just amazing. And that would be land that would be better used for, you know, agriculture, wouldn't it?
Well, it's already happening now. And I've been approached by the Milling Corporation in Queensland saying, can you please, the representative for the millers, sugarcane millers in Queensland, so can you have a look at this, because this is a massive threat and they're actively acquiring farms of all types right now to turn them into solar farms, quite literally. I've got, I've got advertisements and off the internet where they're saying, sell us your farm. You know, we've got investors. And I know at the other end that, in the financial world, I've been well advised that there's just a fervor out there for, institutional funds and the like. They're just all excited about investing in renewables. Now, none of that says that's got nothing to do with delivering cheaper power to mums and dads. It's got nothing to do with making energy more affordable to businesses. That's just a lot of hot investment hype around this industry and a lot of ideological hype from young people, uni students, a lot of people that want to care about the environment and address their social conscience by somehow helping the environment. It's tapping into that artery as well of public sentiment. And I think there's a lot of emotion in that and to the exclusion of a lot of practical realities. And that's of deep concern to me, because already we have enormous Mount Isa, the northwest where I live, which is a fantastic economic contributor to Queensland, always has been. And a lot of our universities and highways and everything have been built off the wealth that's been generated out of these enormous resources here. We've still got $730 billion worth of resources in the ground out here. All the copper you're going to need for those new electric cars, they want to... well, they're only building them overseas, but they want to build them. The zinc to coat your roofing and rust proof your roofing and metal, the zinc, that's all out here. And we've been paying the highest energy prices in the world up until these COVID disruptions. It's thrown the whole energy market globally into a spin. But before that, we were paying the highest industrial energy prices in the world. And they're looking to exacerbate that with these forms of energy. So... And I've got nothing against renewables. And, my dad, as Minister for Northern Development 30 years ago, was put the first solar farm in Queensland up in Torres Strait Island. There's a good place for solar. All the cow coffees love solar out west where they're off the grid, and it makes perfect sense to be pushing it in those areas. There's a place for renewables, and we could be incorporating them, but doing them based on, political expediency and just... riding off that public sentiment and ideology, I think it's fraught with danger. Not only is it fraught with danger, this announcement just confirms that the government is just mad in their pursuit of this, and I can assure you, we'll all be paying the price in, if not 5 years' time, 10 years' time.
Absolutely, and it is very expensive, as you say, and I agree with you, so-called renewables are not necessarily bad things. There is a place for solar out in a station, a very remote station, where it would just cost an absolute fortune to build a power line specifically to some remote place, which only requires a small amount of power. So it makes sense to have it. Yeah, that's right. Hydroelectricity is an excellent form of renewable power. They built the Snowy Mountain Scheme years ago, and it's delivered electricity for decades, and it works very, very well. Those are the sorts of schemes. But the pump hydro in combination with the solar and the wind is just complete nutty stuff. Now, I want to move over. We've got a couple of minutes before the break, but just quickly, you're working on a project for a Australia Post Bank that would help all Australians, and I know rural Australians would particularly benefit, because a lot of banks are just shutting down their branches in rural towns, aren't they?
Yeah, they're shutting down, the closing buildings, shutting down branches, but probably more importantly than shutting down the banks and buildings and the buildings and branches themselves is the fact that they've lost their appetite to lend money in these areas. So, Commonwealth Bank, Westpac, Suncorp, all the major banks would say, we'll still lend out in Charleville or Roma or Richmond or Huon. And we're still lending out there, but it's the terms that they offer someone going for a loan in those areas. So, you might have a loan-to-value ratio of 10% in the southeast corner, they'll ask for 50% deposit. It'll be LVR of 20%, 50% in a rural town, which is completely unaffordable. No one can match that, which just means they don't do loans in those areas. And so you'll never trap them into saying they don't do loans. Well, they do, but they just do them on such expensive or unaffordable terms that you may as well say they just don't lend in those areas. And that's a really big problem. I mean, we can't all live in the southeast corner. And if you're going to put the handbrakes on development like that, well, we may as well pack up now and just move to the coast, because without that fluidity of capital and that lending access and availability and affordability of capital, economies just grind to a halt. And that's what's happening slowly in these areas. You can't sell your tyre shop or your mechanic shop in a small town if someone can't borrow money to buy that. And that's where we are at the moment, because big banks, they don't need the business. There's no social conscience there. And why would you operate in a tiny market that doesn't represent much business? And the flip side of this, though, is to say, well, they're pretty stable towns, a lot of these. They're not growing fast, or a lot of them aren't growing at all, but they're still, they're very stable. They don't fluctuate like city markets. And where markets fail, governments, that's precisely the role of the government to intervene where there's market failure. And so here's an opportunity to offer lending to people that can't get it now and through conventional forms. And guess what? The taxpayer makes money off this. The last time we did this in Queensland, State Development Bank, it sold, it was QIDC, and it sold to Suncorp $1.5 billion. It made money for the taxpayers. Banks make money. And provided you've got competent lending officers, this can work. So it's not often we can take a policy to the table. And here's the good news. Australia Post, New Zealand's already done this. So there's a precedent for it. New Zealand's got a Kiwi bank, and it works effectively.
It works very well. Robbie, we do need to take a quick break, and then we'll be right back. I want to hear more about this Australia Post bank. This is TNT Radio.
You should hear what Jesse Zerowell is talking about.
In addition to calling up 300,000 reservists, which does not include conscripts or university students, Putin has made some what could be described as inflammatory statements, if I can use that cliche, regarding the possible use of nuclear weapons.
In Russian language media, I mean, especially among hardliners, like people who really support the special operation, they're saying this is really, really bad, because first of all, territorial gains aside, what basically has happened is that Russia took control of territory, and then those Ukrainians who wanted to cooperate with Russia and consider themselves Russian, if the idea here was that Russia was going to go into Ukraine to protect ethnic Russians, to guarantee that, you know, Ukrainians can speak Russian and live in harmony and peace with Russia, the problem is that all these territories that Russia goes into, they're not guaranteeing that they're staying, you know? And sometimes, in some cases, they say like, oh yeah, we're here forever. And then, you know, a month later, they leave. How can you do this? It's so self-defeating, and it makes cooperation or welcoming the Russian military as liberators impossible. It's like a death sentence.
Jesse Zerowell on today's News Talk, TNT Radio.
When it comes to making plans, you are the best. Those 9 months were also 273 days of planning. What about your daughter's first costume party? It was out of this world. And let's not forget those barbecues you plan in detail for your family and your more vegetarian by the day best friends. That surprise party for your parents' golden anniversary? You get the golden planning. The same way you plan each detail for those moments, start planning to protect you and your loved ones from a natural disaster. Sign up for local weather and emergency alerts. Prepare an emergency kit and make a family communications plan. Protecting your family is the best plan you can make.
Instead of putting a cracker under a politician, why not some TNT? Today's News Talk Radio, TNT.
This is Jeremy Beck, and my guest is Robbie Katter, member for Traeger in Queensland Parliament. And we have the Australia Post Bank that you were talking about. I want to hear more because I know that the Kiwi Bank in New Zealand has been successful, and we could have a bank here to invest into rural communities and create wealth, as you said.
Yeah, Jeremy, thanks, mate. I really appreciate you taking some interest in this because it mainly affects like the rural and remote areas. But you know, the economy belongs to all of the state, and you know, if there's areas that are dragging the chain, then it's a problem for everyone. It'll pull, has the ability to pull the whole state behind if we're all not going ahead together. And here's a simple and eloquent solution that really makes money for the taxpayer. It's not often you can take solutions for the government table that make money for the taxpayer, because it's business the mainstream banks don't want. And we've proven before that it's business that is viable. It's just not desired. And you can see major banks just don't want to deal in small towns. And the beauty of it is we've got a lot of the infrastructure there. You've got the offices and buildings of the Australia Post. They've already do deposit taking and issuing a bank of cash as well. So they're already doing bank type and acting as quasi banks now. But this is just a step further, moving them into that lending space. So it's a perfectly viable solution, and there's a desperate need for it. And really all we've got against this is the economic rationalists. The academics in university for the last so many years have said that government shouldn't operate in a space that's, can be handled by the private industry. But that's all fine, but there's market failure here, so you need the government to intervene. And mate, we'll continue to push this, and there's a push in federal parliament at the moment. And we can't walk away from it because it's too important an issue, and the consequences are too severe if we don't fix these problems.
Mm. And are there many areas where there's simply no banks in towns in your electorate, for example?
Oh, crikey, we've had. Huon had one closed, Dewey Creek closed, Georgetown closed. This is all within the last few years. Probably over 10 years, I reckon we'd be up around 10 banks had closed. That's just in my electorate alone. So it's happening, and I can't rattle the numbers off the top of my head nationwide, but I do have those numbers, and it's positively scary, the amount of, they're disappearing. And like I said, it mightn't seem like a big deal to people on the coast and the city, but I can assure you it will start to hurt if these things aren't arrested and there's just continual decline across the state. It'll start to affect everywhere, and I just don't think we can afford to cop that.
That's right. And you mentioned before about the Queensland, the state bank that you used to have that made money. A lot of people are anti-government because they tax us and cost us, but this made it, didn't it? So tell us just in the last couple of minutes we have left about how that made money and how it was so successful.
Well, it was, to be fair, it was focused on rural loans. And I remember talking to the head of that bank. He said, well, I can't recall, and they were supposed to be a lender of last resort, sort of thing. So I was taking distress clients. They didn't take on everyone, mind you. Like, not everyone's going to get a loan. It's not a magic pudding, nor should any economy be. You can't float all boats, but those people that can demonstrate that they've got a wage and they're a reliable prospect, I'd hope to think that we do want to sort of back those people in Australia and in Queensland. And that's what they did in QIDC. If you were in trouble and couldn't fit the criteria of the major lenders, you went to the rural bank, QIDC, and the head of that bank said he was head of it for 4 or 5 years and he can't recall ever having one default. So think about how much money, how much profit banks make each year, and if you don't have any defaults, you're doing extremely well. And, you could even charge a premium on your interest rates over what the commercial banks do, because the fact is at the moment banks don't even lend in these areas. So even if you offered any sort of loan and it wasn't competitive, they'd still be happy. So, they have the potential, and the aim shouldn't be to make money out of them. It should be to serve a function. But you know, the beauty of this as a policy is that at the same time they can make money. So why we wouldn't be just jumping headfirst into this, I don't know. But I think I think we've inherited enough governments that they blindly follow economic rationalists that just say, you know, government should never intervene, regardless of what the facts or what the case is. And you've got immature and incompetent politicians that just don't have either have the intelligence or the courage to follow something based on the rights and wrongs. They just, they can't think for themselves. So I think that's the other part of the problem.
Yeah, I think so. I agree. Now, Robbie Katter, we have run out of time. It's fantastic to have you on TNT Radio once again. We have to go to the news headlines. This is TNT Radio.
Matt Boyland here with a look at your TNT headlines. Military analysts have sounded the alarm over Washington's endless support for Ukraine, warning that it doesn't have a bottomless pit of weapons and munitions to give away. The United States is emerging as the most likely culprit behind the attack on Russia's Nord Stream pipelines, and Australia will start administering COVID booster shots to babies after the country's medical regulator granted approval to use Pfizer's booster shot on infants as young as 6 months.
We're at a party. Three little kids were playing in the pool, all under five. Adults were busy talking, glanced over, noticed a little one underwater. I think she needs help. That's how easily something can happen. It only takes a few seconds. Don't worry, the party had a happy ending. But we need to remember, fence the pool, shut the gate. Teach your kids to swim, it's great. Supervise, watch your mate, and learn how to resuscitate. I'm Laurie Lawrence. Kids Alive, do the five.
Why not give TNT Radio a follow? We're on all major social platforms, including Facebook, Twitter, Instagram, Gab, and Getter. Help us get the word out as we cover the biggest topics of our time right here on today's News Talk.
TNT Radio.
TNT Radio.
Jeremy Beck back again, and my next guest will be Dr. Alan Moran. But first of all, we have shocking news out of Europe, with the Nord Stream 1 and 2 pipelines being damaged as a possible act of sabotage. Nord Stream 2 is a 1,234-kilometre-long natural gas pipeline from Russia to Germany running through the Baltic Sea, financed by Gazprom and several European energy companies. It was started in 2011 to expand the Nord Stream line and double annual capacity to 110 billion cubic metres. It was completed in September 2021, but has not yet entered into service, with much political controversy over fears that Russia would use it for geopolitical advantage with Europe and Ukraine. The start of the Russia-Ukraine conflict stopped its certification by Germany. What are some of the implications of the damage to this pipeline? Dr. Alan Moran is Principal of Regulation Economics. He is a noted economist who has analysed and written extensively throughout his career and played a leading role in the development of energy policy and competition policy in Australia. He is also very much knowledge on energy policy and supply in other parts of the globe. Welcome to TNT Radio, Alan.
Hi, Jeremy. Pleased to be here.
Yep, likewise. And this is very, very big news. I think sabotage on, I believe, both the Nord Stream 1 and 2 pipelines. This is quite shocking. Can you explain the significance of this pipeline and which countries it supplies with Russian gas?
Yeah, well, as you said, 2 isn't working at the present time, and 1 has been effectively closed. So there's kind of the significance of the sabotage in the short term is virtually zero, because neither of the pipelines are operating. And it's intriguing as to what has caused this sabotage. It almost certainly is sabotage. Whether, in fact, the Russians are suggesting it might even be the United States. United States and others are saying it's probably the Russians. But then if it's the Russians, why are they damaging pipelines which they partly own when they can simply switch off the gas? These are intriguing questions which will doubtless be answered over the coming months. But the implications, the wider implications, are that that Germany is in dire straits in terms of its energy supply as a result of its decision to to switch off its domestic production and rely upon Russian gas. I think everyone has, well, many people have seen the pictures of Donald Trump lecturing the German delegation at the UN, which is, it actually included the German energy minister, and telling them that this was a mistake to put all their apples in that one basket, and they were all sniggering at this buffoon, telling them that they were putting their economy in danger. And of course, now they're not sniggering so much anymore. But the answer is that Germany was reliant upon Russian gas for 60% of its gas. And this has come from different directions. Originally, Germany was spooked by the general global warming issue, and it had decided to move to nuclear. Then, of course, Nakashima happened in Japan, and Germany got spooked by that, decided it was going to close the nuclear and move to gas. And the gas source was plentiful, was from Russia, gas and renewables. He was going to do both those two. His gas is now cut off. It doesn't have a ready supply of gas from anywhere else, because unlike, say, the United Kingdom or France or Italy, it hasn't got ports in which you can import the gas. Its gas was all came from pipeline. So essentially, the outcome of the loss of Russian gas is going to be a severe curtailment of use of electricity and gas in Germany during the coming months. They will probably mitigate the effects of this on households by forcing industry to shut down. And indeed, they've got very high prices for gas anyway, and that's happening. Industry is shutting down and relocating to the United States and other places where gas is more plentiful. But of course, that relocation, whilst it sort of mitigates the effects on the consumer in the next few months, it has a disastrous effect in terms of the economy. Essentially, Germany is an industrial economy. It's an economy which requires huge amounts of electricity and gas, and it's already penalized these by high prices, and now the prices are shooting even higher. So the implications for Germany are terrible. The rest of Europe are also bad, but Germany in particular. And I noticed the UK is now examining its gas supply, because although it only gets about 5 or 10% of its gas from Russia, it gets an awful lot from Norway as well as the North Sea, and so it is considering itself to be somewhat vulnerable.
So I understand that at the time of this potential sabotage, both pipelines were not carrying gas. Well, they had gas in them, that they weren't supplying gas, even right. The Nord Stream 1. But the implications from what you're saying is that Europe is heading into winter, and they would be presumably wanting a lot of that gas, and they won't be getting it. So they're in deep trouble, aren't they?
They're in terrible trouble. I mean, the gas price is five and ten times as high as it is here in Australia or in the United States. The shortages are dire, and certainly there is a very considerable concern. And in fact, they've been adversely affected even more by decisions of the government to close down nuclear power. I mean, you have in Germany, the vice chancellor is a Green, and the Greens actually cut their teeth. Basically, the reason for living was to close down nuclear, and that's what they've done by and large. And they've closed down. They've got two more plants, which they're basically saying, well, we'll leave these going for a few more months to keep deferring the time in which these plants are going to be closed. But can you imagine anything as stupid as saying, well, we've got this terrible problem, we've been cut off from Russian gas, and we've decided to cut ourselves off from Russian gas. We're now going to cut ourselves off from our own domestic nuclear, which is just pouring fire on fire and making the situation far worse. It's just only the Greens would adopt policies like this. And one wonders whether the German government can survive this winter. You'd think it would be overturned in some way.
It's a real worry. But also there is another Baltic pipeline that opened on the same day. Don't know whether that's a coincidence, but anyway, so gas supplies will increase over time through that pipeline, presumably. Which countries will this Baltic pipeline supply, and what proportion of the Nord Stream 1 and 2 supplies could it replace, if any?
Not an awful lot. It's basically using Norwegian gas. And it's a valuable gas, but nothing like the quantities that would come from Russia. The only way Germany can get gas of the quantities needed is to import it from Africa or Australia even. But then it hasn't got ports. It would have to build ports to process that gas from ships, and that's a two or three or four year timeline.
Well, it's a big problem for Germany and other nations. Which nations do you think outside of Germany would be most affected?
All along that area there, you'd think certainly the Netherlands is affected, and that also Netherlands is also under sort of a green governance. I mean, they have a lot of their domestic gas, but they've decided that this is politically incorrect and they're finding problems with it. They too have cut down on their gas. Belgium had, like France, gone nuclear over 20-30 years and still has a huge nuclear fleet, but it's been closing its nuclear plants. It closed one this week actually in response to the general feeling that we've got that the whole world has got to go to renewable energy, which the experts that we've chosen tell us is cheaper, the cheapest form of energy. But even though it's the cheapest form of energy, ironically, it still needs massive subsidies in order to compete. So how does that account for it? The answer is it may be cheap, but it's only cheap when the supplier chooses to supply or is able to supply. It's not cheap when you want it. And those countries and this virtually means all countries who are elected to switch to a renewable-based economy for energy are seeing prices skyrocketing. And we saw in Australia that today, in fact, or yesterday, decisions by the Queensland government to go this route. The Americans have gone this route, although there'll be checks and balances there, which will stop them going as far as Europe has gone. The whole nature of economic production is based on cheap energy. And yet what politicians have done, they've overridden this, or they've been seduced by the idea that the cheap energy means renewable energy, that is wind and solar, and that if we can clobber coal and get gas out of the way and get nuclear out of the way, then our economies will be running sweetly and cheaply on renewable energy. This does not exist. This is not going to exist anywhere in the world. It is inconceivable. And basically those countries going fastest down that route, which means Germany, which means the UK, which means Denmark and places like that, that those countries are seeing the highest energy costs and seeing that the real adverse effects in terms of their industrial structure.
That's right. And France has the biggest fleet of nuclear reactors, and without them, they would be stuffed. And other European countries rely on some of their electricity because they have effectively a European electricity market. Is that correct? Does it go right across Europe, or is it just some countries trade electricity with each other?
Well, it is an open market, so they do trade freely with each other. France has been insulated from these problems because of its nuclear fleet, which was about 60 or 70% of their requirements produced by nuclear, and much of the rest was by hydro. They've unfortunately run into problems with nuclear because there are engineering problems in terms of steel problems within the nuclear plant, which is causing reliability. And many of them, I think about a third of the nuclear fleet is presently offline awaiting repair. France had decided, like the rest of Europe, at one stage to say, well, you know, nuclear, whew, thing of the past, we got to go to this newfangled stuff called wind and solar. That Macron had gone in that direction. He markedly changed course towards the end of last year as some of these problems were looming on the horizon. And France is again now dedicated to a nuclear future, but it does have these immediate problems, and these problems look like they'll be lasting for the next year or so in terms of the reliability of its existing plant. UK has also gone that route, and I think I mentioned before, they are concerned about their availability of gas as a result of some reliability problems or some vulnerability to import from Norway, given the fact that we've had this sabotage on the Russian lines. UK, of course, it's change of government. In a quandary where it goes, because on the one hand, they now say, well, that big decision we made to abolish fracking was all wrong. UK has massive amount of gas if it fracks, but the man who is the present chancellor, Kwesi Kwarteng, it basically has had abolished fracking and forbidden it. They've now changed course on that, and they're now going full pelt in terms of fracking. But that will be a few years before they actually get gas supplies online.
Well, there's going to be an energy crisis for sure, just as soon as next winter, and over the next years, it's going to be very uncertain. We need to take a break now, and then we'll be right back. This is TNT Radio.
Give me a minute with TNT Radio's Steve Malzberg.
I love when conservatives come to the rescue of other conservatives. Tooting their own horn, Fox News says Facebook has reversed a permanent ban on conservative children's book publisher Brave Books after Fox Business started asking questions about the ban. Brave Books publishes books for 4 to 12-year-olds. They told Fox that Facebook suspended them and denied an appeal. The publisher says they put out books that have pro-God, pro-America, and anti-woke values. Brave Books founder Trent Talbot called the suspension an existential threat to the company since they rely on Facebook advertising. The publisher produced a Facebook message which provided no explanation for the ban and stated that it was their final decision. Talbot called the incident a prime example of big tech today, adding they shut down small companies who say anything contrary to their woke agendas. And according to Talbot, a suspension from Google earlier this year was also reversed after Fox News reported on it. Thanks for giving me a minute. I'm Steve Malzberg for TNT Radio.
Challenging the consensus and debunking the narrative. This is Viewpoint.
Ukrainian President Zelensky is among five people named as recipients of the John F. Kennedy Profile in Courage Award for acting to protect democracy. President Zelensky was chosen because he has marshaled the spirit, patriotism, and untiring sacrifice of the Ukrainian people in a life or death fight for their country. The John F. Kennedy Library Foundation said, in response, journalist Gonzalo Lira asked, so when you shut down opposition news channels, persecute journalists critical of you, imprison your political opponents, and in some cases have them murdered, that's defending democracy?
Why listen to TNT Radio? Because friends don't let friends listen to mainstream media. Today's News Talk, TNT Radio.
This is Jeremy Beck, and my guest is Dr. Alan Moran. And we've been discussing the implications of the Nord Stream 1 and 2 pipelines being damaged, possible sabotage, it looks like. But there are many issues in terms of energy there, and we discussed nuclear power too. The problem is that even if Europe changes their position on nuclear power, it will take about 5 years or so just to build a reactor before it's up and running. That's a big problem, isn't it, Alan?
That's a colossal problem. It's so difficult to see a way out of the European bind in anything like the short term and in anything like 5 years' time. I mean, and when you say it'll take 5 years, the permitting of these nuclear power stations has hardly begun. And in terms of Germany's situation, well, they've still got a weird coalition government of free marketers and Greens, and the Greens are adamantly opposed to any new nuclear. You know, the Germany is really at the center of the problem for Europe. You know, it's only in the 2021 election, the Chancellor Olaf Scholz declared, you know, my goal is industrial electricity price at 4 cents. Well, today it's 10 times that. You know, can you imagine, you know, in less than a year, it's 10 times. How can a government possibly survive, or how can it look the electors in the face and say, you know, I was so wrong. I mean, I'm such a failure. But, you know, that's the way Germany has gone. And there's massive close downs of plants. Doubtless, they will get through it because they will borrow from the future, if you like, which is what everybody else is doing. And, close down production and therefore subsidize people with handouts. But you know, that's no solution. That might be a short-term solution for 3 months, but this is a five-year problem they've got. How you do it, I don't know. The European the EU UK basically, as I said, is now in a fracking process, but it's also said, oh well, you know, the price, it recognized the price was going to be six times the household prices, six times what it was a year or so ago, by April of this coming year. So the new government said, no, we're going to cap the price and it will only be twice as much. Fair enough. But where do you get the money from? And they said, oh, well, we're just going to print it, which is a great idea until then the pound has collapsed as a result of that, because printing money basically means your bondholders can see that the value of those bonds in the future is going to be diminished. Pound has collapsed, and then it's all hands to the pump. What do we do now? And they don't know what to do now. There's not an easy way out of it. Once you've actually destroyed production in some way, then you can't readily resurrect it. And I think
very true. This is the very problem true.
That we may find in Australia. You know, we're gallantly going along this road. We're closing down coal power stations, closing down gas, replacing them with wind and solar, which is highly unreliable, building massive amounts of new transmission to try and get this wind and solar to the marketplace, building new batteries at a rate which is just impossible to imagine. We've got some things called pump storage, which Queensland has announced two pump storage schemes, one of which is almost twice as big as the biggest in the world. That's what it says it's going to do. These are very, very expensive replacements. And if this is the energy transition, it's an energy transition from low-cost energy to high-cost and unreliable energy, and will impoverish those nations doing it unless there is an about turn.
Exactly right. And it has a huge impact on manufacturing, smelting operations.
Right.
Are you seeing evidence of this in countries, particularly in Europe, because we were discussing Europe, but other countries as well, where manufacturing and smelting operations are closing because of the cost of energy and doing business?
Yeah, there's massive amount, hundreds of thousands of German plants which are saying that they're cutting their production because of the high cost of energy. And what the really interesting thing over the weekend is in Italy, where there again there was a very, very big increase in power prices. Italy is also somewhat dependent on Russian gas, and there's been a big close down of their service sector as a result of that. And yet, and now we've had Giorgia Meloni's so-called far-right party, the Brothers of Italy, winning a massive election victory. And she's definitely saying she's going to end the high prices and wants more fracking for gas, more imports of gas from elsewhere. And her political allies are also talking about a renewed thrust for nuclear power. So, you know, that here we're seeing common sense being applied, and of course she's denigrated by the mainline media, who basically all say, oh, she's far right, she's Mussolini with a skirt on and things, which is a total nonsense. All she's saying is we have got ourselves into an impasse through various ways, through these woke policies, not only in energy, she's talking about other aspects as well, and that she is going to reverse all these. And that's a really refreshing scene to see in Europe. For the first time, we're seeing a major country now saying we're going to reverse course, but this has gone too far and is impoverishing us.
Mm. Well, certainly she said some very good statements that I've seen, although I don't agree with her on Ukraine. I think it's very dangerous to continue feeding weapons to Ukraine and dragging on that war and having geopolitical tensions with Russia and United States continuing is very dangerous. But in other areas, I think she's, you know, very refreshing change. Mm-hmm. Now, the implications on the economy with this, you know, gas issue in Europe, you know, I think we'll see some sharp changes over the next 6 to 12 months. How do you see it happening over that kind of a time frame, 6 to 12 months?
Well, I mean, we'll see, yeah, as you say, sharp changes, a deindustrialization. We basically, firms in Europe and particularly in Germany are offloading their production or their outputs to subsidiaries outside of Germany and outside of Europe if they can. And the outcome of that means a massive reduction in GDP, which means a massive reduction in living standards. And that can be staunched for a while because you can simply print money or whatever. And Germany is in a is extremely rich, and it can probably do so for longer than others. But you know, as the UK is finding that they had a great idea. We're going to spend a £300 billion plus program to keep electricity prices down and do various other things. And the irony is that Chancellor put his mini budget in with all this happening, and within, you know, a minute or so, the pound actually rose quite a lot, and the treasurer, the secretary to treasury tweeted, "Oh, it's great, we've got a winner here." 5 minutes later, the pound collapsed, massively collapsed, and there was a crisis on, and suddenly the bondholders were selling UK bonds all over the world and bringing about a collapse in those bonds, which means it was making it very difficult for the UK to raise the money to finance its $300 billion program. So, you know, there isn't an easy way out of it. You can live off the fact that you've created it in previous decades of sound governance. You can do that for so long. But after a while, that runs out, and you know, it's difficult to see how Germany can change course and to reestablish a low-cost energy industry over the next 5 years, having wreaked so much destruction on itself by closing its coal mines, closing its nuclear plant, requiring these renewables to be run. It's difficult to know how Germany does change course now, and we may well see that German economic miracle, which has been going on since 1947, suddenly ends in 2022.
Yeah, it's a real worry, and I think even if they had the best of governments, which they certainly don't, they would still be in a lot of trouble because, as I said before, it takes 5 years or so to get a nuclear power plant up and running. Similarly, building a coal-fired power station doesn't happen overnight. Right. Now, in terms of the Nord Stream pipelines, is the United States likely to be a beneficiary of this damage?
Well, it may well be, you know, because it's not in terms of the damage doesn't have any immediate effect in terms of the amount of gas that is exported from Russia, and US is to some degree a competitor, although it would find it difficult to ramp up its own production because this has been hampered by the Biden administration. As soon as it got in, it started closing down pipelines and access to gas resources for developers. So US is, you know, has a good buffer for its own protective purposes, but it isn't in a strong position to replace Russia as a result of their own domestic policies. So it's not really a beneficiary in that sense. Australia might be a beneficiary if we could get additional gas out there, but then again, the outcome of Australia providing more gas would probably be the price of gas going up here. And I noticed the resources minister negotiated today to try to prevent that happening and try and ensure gas resources aren't cannibalized from domestic use to export. So you know every cloud has a silver lining. Certainly, the beneficiaries.
We've run out of time, Alan. We've got the news coming up in 10 seconds. So it's great to have you on TNT Radio, Dr. Alan Moran. Thanks very much. The news is coming up. This is TNT Radio.